Chapter 1. The Self-Fulfilling Prophecy of Pain.
Dating has been an uphill battle. I think what's most troubling to me about it is that, like, I've always had a gregarious personality and I can connect to people pretty easily. It seems to be really difficult to make and keep connections with people that I'm interested in romantically.
This is Mimi. She's a teacher in New York City in her mid-30s. She originally approached me because she was frustrated with her dating life. Now, to be clear, everyone is frustrated with their dating life in New York City.
New York dating is notorious.
There's always a one-upsmanship. There's always going to be a better apartment. There's always going to be a better job. And people are always looking for those things. Are people dating you for now until they find the better
Something
one?
Something better, yeah. You're just like, well, he or she is cute, but I could go out with like three people next month. Maybe they're better.
Next month? Yeah, tomorrow.
Next week, yeah.
Yeah, tomorrow.
But talking to Mimi further, an interesting dichotomy in her life emerged.
The times in my life that men have showed me the most interest and men have pursued me was when I was a hot mess.
Back when she had a drug and alcohol problem and low self-esteem, men seemed to fall out of the sky for her.
I mean, maybe there was something about that that made me more vulnerable.
But since getting clean and taking care of herself, she's entered into a romantic drought, an 8-year drought. This was unusual. So I decided to sit down with her in studio and see what I could do.
Since I moved to New York, I've gotten better as a person. I've done a lot of work on myself and like I lead an amazing life. Yet for some reason that seems to be repellent.
Yeah.
You know, which I would think that like having a happy, awesome life would be the most attractive thing.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem to be enough.
Okay.
To people that I'm romantically interested in.
Finding a good partner definitely involves a bit of luck. But 8 years is a long time to be unlucky. My theory is that something is off in Mimi's life, that she has a blind spot, but neither of us knows what it is yet. Sometimes just figuring out that blind spot is the most important step, and then the rest just kind of takes care of itself. To get started, I ask her to take me through her relationship history, which is a rolling landscape dotted with red flags.
My first serious relationship was a guy that I met named Justin. And I met him because he was living at this like crash den in the city that I grew up in. And actually the reason that I met him was because an ex-boyfriend of mine from high school who I had remained pretty close friends with was going over there to buy weed.
Okay.
And he was like, why don't you meet us here and we'll all hang out? So
yeah.
So I did. The first time that I met him, like I'm sitting on a crappy mattress on the floor and he comes and sits next to me and just puts his head on my shoulder and that was it.
And how long were you with him?
The entire saga was less than a year. I think I broke up with him the following October, but it took quite a while to actually get him away from me.
And why was that?
Why? He was a mess and he did not take that well.
Yeah.
Honestly, when I entered this relationship with him, it was very short-sighted. Like
yeah,
I wasn't
yeah.
thinking like, oh, I'm going to get married to this
guy.
No, that wasn't crossing my
yeah.
mind at all. I was 17 years old. I was going to be going away to school. I was just like, fuck it. Like, let's just have fun and see where this goes. And I started to see some really kind of weird red flags. But of course, when you're young, you don't know that they're even learned yet that this
yeah.
is something to pay attention to. And I remember going to Florida with my family during April break. So this is like 2 months after I met this guy. When I wasn't answering my phone, he was calling the phone at the place I was staying. And this was like twice a day. And like in my head, something didn't feel right about this. I'm like, I'm away for a week, dude. Like,
it's going to be fine.
It's going to be fine. I mean, but of course, like my head at the time was thinking, oh, that's sweet.
Yeah.
But he ultimately ended up kind of sort of following me to school.
Wow.
And yeah, and it got weird because he started to sell drugs out of my dorm room. And it was a rough semester. I mean, he used to use cocaine a lot as like a tool to control me. And like, it kind of reached this culmination in like September, beginning of October that year. Everything just kind of broke. And I was like, this cannot be happening.
Yeah,
like, I'm supposed to be living my life. Everything that is wrapped around this guy is not functional for me.
Right.
And I was seeing his behavior be more and more like a live wire. Like, he would just get very erratic, very angry, very explosive.
Yeah.
He couldn't handle rejection at all. Like, when I would tell him no, and I would say, like, I really don't want you here, he couldn't handle that. Ultimately, it was very difficult for me to get him out of my life. I ultimately did kick him out of my dorm, but, like, he would incessantly call my phone. My roommates were getting upset about it. He would incessantly call my parents' house. My parents offered to change their phone number, and I was like,
wow.
That's, yeah. And I was like, this, wow. That's, you shouldn't need to do that. I just couldn't anymore.
And so other relationships with guys, did they get better? I hope.
Yeah. They did. They were not nearly that bad.
Yeah.
The next person that I dated after him was actually somebody that was the manager of the coffee shop that I worked at.
Okay.
But it's hard because it's hard for me to actually say we dated. He just kind of like inserted himself into my life and stayed in my apartment periodically throughout the course of a year.
You have these guys that just kind of show up.
They just kind of show up. But I mean, like, I mean, he showed interest in me and he pursued me, and like, I liked him. So I wasn't going to say no. And I welcomed it.
Here we can already identify a pattern. Weird guys who just show up and without stating anything, basically insert themselves into Mimi's life. What's worse is that Mimi just lets them.
Granted, she was young and doing a lot of drugs.
But this is the first tip-off of what's going on with her.
That she doesn't seem to have a sense of what a normal relationship boundary looks like.
So this new guy, he had a hitchhiking habit. He had a habit of just kind of being like, well, I feel like going to Kentucky and just like disappear. And there's like a part of that that's kind of alluring and romantic. I'm like, yeah, I want to say fuck the world and go hitchhike somewhere too. That'd be great.
Yeah.
I never could definitively decide if we were actually dating or not.
Okay.
He would stay at my house. And, you know, we would like mess around. He would cook me dinner. He would buy me flowers. But then, like, when we were hanging out with friends or anything, he wasn't affectionate. He wouldn't refer to me as his girlfriend. His friends would.
Yeah.
Oddly.
Okay.
His friends would be like, oh, yeah, like, you know, the relationship, like your boyfriend, Kevin. Or
did you ever ask him about this stuff?
When I tried to, he would get really defensive and dismissive of it. And like, why do you need to put a label on it, man? And I'm like, oh, God. Yeah, because you're clearly not willing or able to take responsibility for the relationships in your life because you like to disappear.
Hitchhike to Kentucky.
Hitchhike to Kentucky or Texas or wherever the place du jour is. But while I was seeing Kevin, the second guy, my ex, the reason that I was in the crash house to buy weed from, he commits suicide.
This ex, by the way, is a guy Mimi dated earlier in high school, before she met Justin or Kevin.
Yeah, I had asked Kevin. I said, listen, like, this is a really difficult thing for me. And if there's anything that you could do, please just go with me to the funeral because I don't know that I can do this by myself.
Yeah.
And he, in the moment, he was like, of course, of course, of course. Well, the day of, I'm trying to find him only a few hours before I'm supposed to go to the funeral, and he's MIA. Kevin ended up calling me 3 days later from Texas. And I was just like, what the fuck? Why? Like, you told me that you would do this for me because I needed you, and, like, you decided to take flight? I mean, he basically was just trying to, like, okay, we'll talk about it when I get back. And that really just never happened. And I just more or less kicked him out of my house and I said no more.
Why have a relationship if somebody's not there when the shit hits the fan?
Right. I mean, and I think sometimes people don't understand, like, physically being present is not the same as emotionally being present and available.
Yeah.
And he was neither.
So how did things evolve for you? I mean, it sounds like a lot of dysfunctional men.
In a short period of time, yeah. Yeah. Well, just men that were just not particularly available and men that were not particularly interested in being available to me.
It's clear that Mimi's history with men is horrible. You have an early boyfriend who ends up dying later on, a first love who sold drugs in her dorm room, used substances to manipulate her, and obsessively called her, another boyfriend that peaced out to another state when she needed him the most.
To be honest, being single for 8 years is probably an upgrade.
People who experience a lot of trauma in their relationships often develop defense mechanisms, ways to avoid intimacy or protect themselves from being exposed to others. Oftentimes, these defense mechanisms are extremely subtle, and the person struggles to spot them herself. My hunch is that Mimi developed some defense mechanisms that closed her off to intimacy with new men. But because they are so subtle and they have gone on for so long, she doesn't notice them. To her, they are simply what normal feels like.
Then, just as I'm thinking this, she drops this bombshell.
Shortly thereafter, I had gone to Kevin's house to give him some of his stuff, and it was very calm. Nobody was fighting. Nobody was upset. And when I left his house, it was like a suburban neighborhood, and I was driving down the street, and I turned to grab my cell phone off of the seat of my car, and I swerved, and I hit a parked car doing about, I don't know, 35, 40 miles an hour. So, I mean, it was considerable damage, but I looked up and I saw a man running towards my car. The first thought in my mind was like, oh, this person's concerned about my safety, because my car, half of it was crunched in. And I realized, like, I'm touching my body. I'm really, okay, I'm not hurt. I'm fine. So I undo my seatbelt and I open my door to try to get out of my car to show this person that I'm okay. And he grabs my arm and he grabs my neck and he drags me out of the car. And he says, you drunk bitch, you just hit my car. You're going away for a really long time. And he proceeds to drag me onto the sidewalk and he's like kicking the hell out of me, trying to get me to stop moving. And he tells me he's a police officer. He tells me, repeating that I'm the drunk bitch that hit his car. I remember there was a moment when I told myself, like, whatever's going to happen, you're going to let it happen. And you're going to deal with it later. He ultimately did get off of me to go call the cops. And when he did that, of course, I ran and got my phone. And the first person I called was Kevin because he was the closest. He was right around the corner. He did show up. The cops were already there. Everybody was there at that point. He did drive me to the police department so I could file the charges. And he drove me to the hospital. He called my parents. And so, I mean, that was the best of him. I still wasn't going to take him back, but yeah, that was the best of him I saw that night. And ultimately, with regards to that situation, like, I never actually dealt with that until 10 years later. I know that was kind of a moment for me. Like, I had had all of these dysfunctional relationships with men. And I think there was very, very much something about that situation that just pushed me to the extreme and was just like, okay, if I didn't think men had my best interests in mind before, they certainly as shit don't now.
Yeah.
And like, just tried to muscle through it and try to act normal. And when that happened, it was at a point when I was quitting drugs. I wasn't doing coke anymore. I wasn't doing ecstasy anymore. I was smoking like chimney, but but I mean, I was on a very much upward path. And then this happened, and I still didn't continue drugs. Like, I still got better, but I can very definitively say now that I definitely substituted drinking for that, because I think that was how I dealt. There was a lot of anger that I swallowed, and there was a lot of stuff wrapped up in that I just kind of ate.
And here we get a clue to what's been going on. Mimi pushed out the trauma and tried to muscle through the pain, despite enduring disappointment after disappointment. Essentially, she shut herself off to intimacy. It's what we all do when we sustain intense amounts of emotional pain. We numb ourselves and hide ourselves and move on. For years, she did this by getting totally blasted.
You moved to New York. You replaced the drugs with the drinking.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of sex.
So you kind of just gave up on the intimacy thing. You're like, you know what? I'm just going to go out and drink and bang and have a good time.
Yeah.
So let's jump ahead. Well, when did you start, for lack of a better word, fixing things with yourself? Like, when did things start getting better?
I started to take my health a little bit more seriously. I woke up one morning to go to work, and I lost nerve function on the left side of my body.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, like, I was getting dressed and, like, started in, like, my neck area and started to, like, pins and needles sensation down my arm. ultimately, like, it ended up dissipating.
So it wasn't a stroke?
There was no evidence of stroke in the MRI.
Okay.
Turns out my brain is really sexy, though. Yeah, that's what the MRI said. It said, look at this.
Yeah.
So I was diagnosed with a migraine with paresthesia. And that was kind of the moment when I started to put two and two together and be like, I need to take my health more seriously, and I need to evaluate my drinking habits and my partying habits. And like, after that happened, I definitely was more conscious in changing habits that were not good for me health-wise. Yeah. I got a lot of shit under control around the 28, 29 area.
And no significant relationships.
Since then?
Since then, yeah. Okay.
Not really. I mean, there is a man that kind of hovers in the background in my life. Mm-hmm. I'm not really sure what to do with him.
I'm like, have this mental image of a guy like,
it's just like, hey, girl.
In your backyard, like,
hey.
Just hanging out.
Just hanging out. I mean, this is a guy that I was introduced to by a mutual friend. He lived in New Jersey. He's also a very sweet guy, but sometimes I feel like I have to pull information out of him. Like, I've known him more or less for about 4 years, and there are some really basic things about him. Like, I don't know how old he is.
Still?
He just doesn't tell me. Won't. Our birthdays are around the same time. Like, and it's just like some basic things. But I mean, he's a really sweet guy. And like, when we do hang out, it can be like pretty jovial, but it does feel like it's kind of surface. And like, the times when I try to like poke and get more information out of him, it seems like it's kind of a struggle.
Yeah.
It's clear he's attracted to me. It's clear that he's interested in me, and he is persistent as hell. Yeah. But like, I don't know what he wants from me.
This is a mistake a lot of men and women make. Mimi justifies this New Jersey guy's bad behavior by saying he's such a sweet guy. Aw, he's a sweet guy. This often happens to us when we're a bit starved for affection. We become willing to overlook all sorts of questionable behaviors that might be going on in the background. The road to relationship hell is paved with seemingly sweet guys who are otherwise total fuck-ups.
Have you asked him?
Yes, but I was very angry when I did it. I was really angry with him when I did it, because he would ask me to hang out. Like, oh, what are you doing today? Like, I don't have to work. Do you want to hang out? Yeah, sure. I'm in the middle of something right now. Let's hang out later.
Yeah.
And just like, crickets, crickets, crickets. Did you forget? Like, what's going on? I mean, he would try to initiate things with me and then drop the ball, and I'd be like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Like, this is not a good way to get me to like you. If you want to see me, I will make time for you, but I will not chase you. You need to hold up your end of the bargain here, too. And you know, honestly, it has gotten better since I got in his face about it. But I mean, I did kind of have to get, like, really hard on him, because he can't really be clear about what he wants from me.
It's interesting. You definitely have a type.
Yeah.
There's shades of Kevin there. There's shades of Justin there, which is not respecting space or time or being dependable.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. What? Tell me about the dates that you go on recently. Let's say you go on a first date.
Yeah.
And you come away from it like, that went really well. What happened?
It's usually when we get the ball rolling on, when conversation flows pretty easily and pretty openly, when I feel like we're both contributing to the conversation.
Yeah.
The best dates I've been on have been ones that have a very free flow conversation like that, where I feel like we're both coming to the table curious to know more.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it does feel like I'm the only one that's like curious, and I'm like, what are you here for?
Yeah, yeah. Are they flirtatious?
Not always.
Yeah.
It seems kind of businessy sometimes. It seems very transactional as well.
Yeah.
I don't feel like they're trying to charm me. Not usually.
Do you do like cutesy stuff sometimes? Like,
yeah, I try to. If I feel like they're open to it, yes.
Yeah.
Like, if I've had a good date and I feel like that if we've already established that there's a good flow of conversation, yeah, I try to be cutesy, and I try to do.
Okay.
Yeah.
And be a little flirty. Do you ever kiss them on the first date?
No.
Yeah.
I don't like to. I don't like to on the first date, because I feel like the first date is like the preview.
Do they ever try?
Rarely.
Yeah.
Rarely. I mean, and in fact, I would like to see guys take a little more risk with that because, yeah. I don't know, I guess I feel like you want to feel like someone's interested in you. It's like, I got plenty of friends, bro. Like, yeah. not on Tinder to meet more friends. Like, it would be nice to feel like I'm attractive to you.
Yeah.
But maybe not even like attempting the kiss or just doing something cute, like grabbing my hand or something.
Yeah. And that's kind of what I mean by flirtatious.
Yeah.
Because I'm thinking maybe, and tell me if you think you completely disagree with this, but like, maybe these guys are on the other end thinking the same thing. They're like, well, I'm glad we had a great 2-hour conversation, but like, I've got plenty of friends. So one thing I'm kind of thinking while talking to you, it sounds like A, you came from a background like low self-esteem and you self-medicated through all these different means.
Mm-hmm.
And when you talk about the work that you've done on yourself, it sounds like you're talking about that. Like you're healthy now. You're not getting hammered or getting fucked up every weekend. And, and you're treating yourself well and you feel good about yourself. And so like, that's where the work came in. But I think there's another component here, which is pretty much all of your early life intimacy. Let's just say it was substance assisted intimacy, which a lot of people rely on substance for that. Well, now the substance is gone. So maybe it's just that part of you is still underaddressed or underdeveloped. You've solved the self-esteem part of the equation, which honestly is a much more important part, and it probably needed to be solved first. But I feel like there's conversational chemistry. There's like a sexual slash romantic chemistry, and it sounds like that's what's not triggering in a lot of these dates. That you're meeting a lot of guys that you're like, wow, he's really smart and really nice and we had a great conversation and he's doing cool things and I'm doing cool things. And then it's like, well, why didn't he call back? There's not that kind of romantic
switch
going off either. When was the last time you felt like you had intense sexual chemistry or romantic chemistry with somebody? Like, let's set aside the values and the good conversation. Was there ever a guy that you were just like, God, he's fucking hot?
Yeah, I mean, the guy in New Jersey, the peripheral guy.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Like, there is something intensely magnetic about...
That's interesting.
Yeah, about our relationship, but it's very hard for... I don't feel like I can participate with that if I don't feel like I can trust him.
This is something I call the attraction-trust conundrum, and it afflicts a lot of people with histories similar to Mimi's. Different people find different things sexy. Some people find nurturing behavior sexy. Some people find competitiveness or intelligence sexy. Some people find a strong jaw or bitchin' abs sexy. But one thing we all tend to find sexy is mystery. We all love someone who is a little enigmatic, a little bit unpredictable, a little bit unknowable. We're like, hey, look at you with your sly eyes and sweet-ass phone case. Who let you be so dashing? Then you ask them what their name is, and they just roll their eyes and say, I'm not into labels, babe. And even though you know this is the stupidest thing a person could possibly say, you're still somehow incredibly turned on. That's fine. It's just part of our nature. And for most people, this doesn't cause many problems, because we're also sexually attracted to those other things that counterbalance this desire for mystery. You know, things like being trustworthy, or having integrity, or not ghosting your girlfriend the day of her friend's funeral. For most people, attraction to mystery is just one ingredient stirred into the sex pot. The problem arises when you have people like Mimi who have been intensely hurt in the past and struggle to open up and trust anyone they meet. All of these other attraction triggers require some degree of trust. To be turned on by someone who is nurturing, you have to trust that they are actually nurturing. To be turned on by someone who is smart and successful, you have to trust that they aren't full of shit, or in the mob, or cheating on their taxes. In each of these cases, trust is the fuel that makes the sexy engine run. And when you've got no trust, everything just kind of grinds to a halt. Everything except one thing. Mystery. Mystery gains from distrust. The less you trust a person, the more mysterious that person becomes, the hotter they get. And suddenly, you find yourself drawn to this person you don't trust at all. What results is a tragic sort of conundrum, where people who can't trust consistently find themselves sexually attracted to the least trustworthy people. Mimi claims she's been on hundreds of dates. My guess is the majority of these men were basically normal, friendly, trustworthy guys. But because she's shut off from trusting these men, their positive traits do nothing for her. Everything becomes a business-like conversation, transactional in nature. She is guarded and she struggles to flirt or show emotional interest. She prefers to discuss cerebral topics and be intellectual. There's nothing wrong with these things, but by themselves, they don't generate romance or connection. They're merely an exchange of ideas. It's only the man who unpredictably shows up and then disappears once more that strikes her interest. And it's because it's the only route that remains to excite her romantically. Mystery. Ultimately, the goal here is to get Mimi to trust men again. But how the hell do you do that? It's extremely hard. But I can help take her the first few steps. I can encourage her to express her interest more openly and see that nothing bad happens. Step one is to get her to do this with the New Jersey guy, to make it clear that if there's a relationship, it needs to be clear and trustworthy or not exist at all.
Have you had like a serious sit-down talk with him of like, what's going on? Like, this has been going on for years. Clearly, we like each other.
When that happened, it was about a year and a half, 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very angry with him because he had fucked up again. I mean, he had just done something to rub me the wrong way. And I was like, what are you doing? What are you doing here? What do you want from, what kind of relationship do you want to have with me? Because I can't figure out, like, if you want to be my friend or if you want to be my boyfriend.
Yeah.
Like, they're straddling this line and I can't. The best answer he could say was something to the effect of, well, for some people, it takes time for them to know. And I was like, okay, that's fair.
Yeah.
But like,
well, now it's been like
4 years. And I'm like, so you either know or you don't. And I think some of that is hard for me because I am a very overt person. I'm just like, dude, are you in or are you out?
This is the third time Mimi has said that she is very open, confrontational, willing to share herself. It's around this moment that I start to suspect that this is her blind spot. She thinks she's being open and confrontational, yet she continues to let men hang around in her life for years. She says she's interested in men she meets on dates, yet she doesn't follow through and show that interest. Put another way, I think she's good at saying the right words, but she seems to not know how to back those words up with action.
It's been a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
What about sitting down and having this conversation with him calmly? Like, just like, hey.
Not pissed off.
Yeah, just like, I want to, like, talk about this for real. I think that's a good idea. So first of all, if he's the only guy that you feel this, like, really magnetic attraction to.
Yeah.
And he's always lingering in the background. He's always kind of available, but kind of not available. That means a part of you is kind of available, kind of not available when you go see these other guys.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Even though it's not a conscious thing, you know, a lot of these guys you're going on dates with, you sense that. You're like,
mm-hmm.
There's a part of her that's kind of like sectioned off. So that's your homework.
That is my homework. Have a talk with him and be like, bro, what's up?
And if he's a person who
is evasive, because that seems to be what I get from him a lot.
Yeah, I mean, if he gets a little evasive, just kind of acknowledge it and just be like, look, you know, I know you get uncomfortable when we talk about this, but
yeah.
Like, tell me how you feel. And it's, if you want to take your time to answer, like, that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair.
Yeah.
That's fair.
Well, hey, 4 years.
Well, 4 years that he's been making, he's like the Steve Urkel of my life, where he'll just kind of like, he's like the neighbor that lives next door and just be like, hey, you want to hang out?
Barges in.
Mimi's struggle exemplifies a common struggle that we all sort of know. Pain fucks us up. The way this happens is actually pretty simple. The more some experience hurts you, the more irrational fear and anxiety you carry around that experience throughout your life. If, as a child, your family is in a serious car accident, you can develop intense fears and anxiety around cars or traveling. If your father always ditched you to go bowling, then you'll likely grow up with a severe hatred of bowling, which is fine, because bowling kind of sucks. But if both of your significant relationships resulted in years of pain and sorrow, well, then you will naturally be incredibly fearful going into any future romantic relationship. When someone in our life that we care about hurts us, we develop habits and behaviors that protect us from ever being hurt in that way again. In Mimi's case, she had the drugs and alcohol to numb her pain and hide her real self. But she also avoided conflict, hid her feelings, and became naturally distrustful of the men in her life. This went on for so long that she began to believe that this was normal and not something to be overcome, that a guy just showing up at her house and ambiguously planting himself on her sofa was an acceptable way to demonstrate romantic interest. Much of this project is about unraveling the narratives we tell ourselves that prevent us from opening up and experiencing healthy intimacy. We all have those stories, and they're all slightly different. The same day I speak to Mimi and send her out to confront this New Jersey guy, I hop on the phone with a man named Jerry. Jerry's in his 50s. He's a businessman. He's from Wyoming. In many ways, Jerry is your typical American everyman. He enjoys playing golf, watching basketball, and getting divorced. Jerry's been divorced twice. Both divorces wrecked him, emotionally and financially. He's reached out to me because he finds himself in a new relationship. But considering his shitty track record, he's terrified with how to proceed.
Okay, so I got two things I'm struggling with. Number one is dealing with my ex-wife who kind of won't go away. There's a nice way to put it. She's like a pain in my ass and still sends me text messages and just hasn't really moved on. So that's dealing with her. And then number two is I'm in a new relationship now and it's really difficult for me. I obviously don't have good relationship skills because I keep getting in fucked up relationships that end badly. And so maybe I learned something on A, how to pick up on problems earlier, and B, you know, actually do something about them.
Okay.
Because I tend to be complacent or optimistic or whatever, and I stay in my shit way too long.
Perfect.
That's what I did in failed marriage number two.
You said your current relationship is difficult. What do you mean by that?
Difficult in that I have issues with intimacy, like getting too close too fast. And so I feel like I get too close, I'm going to start suffering again.
Yeah.
And so I keep my distance, you know, emotionally. And that's probably not a part of the secret sauce for awesome relationships.
Not that I know of. Let's start with the ex-wife.
Okay.
So you said that she keeps contacting you.
Yeah, it has started to decline.
Mm-hmm.
It's less. I got hate mail and hate texts almost like every day for about 9 months.
Wow.
You know, that I ruined her life.
How often does she text you now?
Maybe once a week.
Yeah. And it's still hateful stuff?
No, actually the hate has stopped. She was asking me for dating advice.
Okay. That's
that's so fucked up.
Yeah, you don't seem like the most appropriate person for her to
right.
be
asking. I know. Why would you, you know, she's like, I'm on match.com and it's like, really?
Yeah. She's probably trying to make you jealous.
I'm such a dumbass. I fucking answer her texts, you know? Why do I do that? I should just ignore them, right? But
yeah, why do you do that? Do you feel guilty?
I feel really guilty.
Yeah.
I have a lot of guilt around this whole thing because I was the one that walked out. I left after 20 years, you know? And then she beat that into my head. You left. You gave up on us. But it was more complicated than that.
Of course.
You know, she's anorexic. Been struggling with that since she was a teenager, you know? So she had a lot of issues. She had her own issues. I was kind of codependent with that stuff.
So what ultimately led you to decide to end it?
I told her, you need to get help and get fixed or I'm leaving.
Has she tried to get help in the past?
Yeah. Oh, fuck. I've spent tens of thousands of dollars on shrinks and hospitals. She's been hospitalized, all kinds of stuff.
This is a tough spot. On the one hand, Jerry's ex-wife has some serious mental health issues going on. As third parties to this relationship, it's important that we have compassion for her. But we also need to understand that Jerry is coming out of 20 years of a broken and miserable marriage. He's hurt. He's resentful. He's scared and he feels terribly guilty. And while I hope the ex-wife gets well, my focus needs to be on Jerry and helping him manage the situation as best he can, which in this case means managing his communication with her.
I imagine earlier in the marriage, you felt some sort of responsibility or loyalty to like help her through that.
Yeah, I did. I mean, you know, when I met her and see, here's, you know, I met her and we got married 6 months later in Vegas at the drive-up wedding window.
and you made it 20 years. Holy shit.
I know, right? Go figure. And, you know, she didn't eat terribly healthy, but I didn't really care or pay attention to it.
How old were you?
30.
Yeah.
Right? Smart enough to know better, maybe?
Well, depends. some of us are doing better than others at 30. So was it happy early on? Like, how long would you say that the marriage was good, or was it ever good?
It was good for about a year.
Okay.
And then it kind of sucked for 19.
How did it start sucking? Like, what changed?
Let's see. After about a year, we moved to Cleveland. And that part didn't really suck, although, depending how you feel about Cleveland. I mean, I kind of felt like I got tricked. You know, when we met, our sex life was awesome.
Yeah.
For like a year, and then it went to shit.
Mm-hmm.
And she had no interest in it.
Okay. Dude, time out for a second. One thing I've noticed over the years is that men are generally far less aware and or comfortable discussing emotional intimacy than women are. Instead, they often perceive or discuss intimacy in terms of sex. This is particularly true with older guys like Jerry. This often throws women for a loop and makes men appear more shallow than they actually are. The truth is that Jerry suffered for many, many years by feeling disconnected and unwanted by his wife. That would make anybody feel weak and vulnerable. But as we know, men aren't supposed to feel weak or vulnerable. So instead of talking about feeling unwanted or unloved, they talk about it in the only socially acceptable way they know how: not getting laid. What I've learned over many years working with men is to translate these statements. Sex is itself a form of intimacy, an expression of intimacy. Really, what Jerry's complaining about here is that within a year of getting married, his sense of connection with his wife went to shit, and it never came back. A good tip for people in relationships with more old-school dudes is to translate discussions or comments about sex as discussions or comments about how close they feel to you. Men who begin to feel distance or coldness will often notice and complain about the lack of sex before anything else, even though sex isn't necessarily the root of the problem. We're not just walking penises. A lot of men never develop the emotional awareness or communication tools to recognize what a lack of intimacy feels like. Okay, end dude timeout. Back to the conversation.
What about, like, spending time together and...
Yeah, I worked a lot. I was a little workaholic-ish, so that probably didn't help a lot. And she had nobody but me, right? She has no job. She has no friends. She's in a strange town, and she's just relying on me for everything. And I'm really busy. I'm starting, you know, I have a new job, so I didn't pay a lot of attention to her.
It sounds like nobody was particularly happy. Did you guys try to change it? Did you talk about it? Did you try to fix it, or was it?
Yeah, I guess so. We spent a few years in Cleveland, and then I got an opportunity to come back. You know, I don't know. It was just okay. You know, we got along pretty well, you know, so we didn't fight much, but I kind of lived my own life in a way. You know, I was just, my sex life sucked. I just came to accept that it was going to suck.
So you just kind of checked out.
Yeah.
Another parallel with Mimi. Jerry developed a habit of numbing his emotions because they were too painful. This developed into a sort of addiction. Whereas Mimi was addicted to drugs and partying, Jerry became addicted to his work.
In my job, and probably almost every job, there's always something to do. You're never done. You know, I like what I do, and so I spend a lot of time on that. Did I use that to avoid her? Yeah, probably. Yes.
And so when the breaking point came, what brought that on? Like, what made you decide, like, all right, you know what, I'm not going to, there's an ultimatum here.
Yeah. So, you know, halfway through the marriage, we went to like marriage camp and tried to fix it. I don't know if you've heard of those places.
Is it actually called marriage camp?
No, it has another name. I don't remember what.
It has like cabins and board games and.
Yeah. You ride horses. No, it was at like some swanky place in Arizona, and it was actually pretty good. And we came out of there, and we were thinking maybe we can fix this and the intimacy issues, and it was better for like a week.
Yeah.
You know, and then you get back, and your life goes back to normal, and it was. And so it didn't work. And then we muddled through for another 10. And then, you know, I got to the point where I was never going to have sex again ever the rest of my life. So that didn't sound awesome.
Jerry keeps referring to the relationship problems in terms of sex. I'm going to keep challenging him on this until he drops the macho act and starts talking about intimacy like an emotionally mature human being. He catches on pretty quick.
Was it just about the sex, though?
No, it was about the intimacy. It was about, you know, being able to connect with someone, and I couldn't connect with her, you know? And so that was never going to happen. And oddly enough, that's the problem I have now in the new one is like, I left because I wanted connection, and now I can have it and I don't want it. Or I'm afraid of it.
Right.
Isn't that fucked up?
Right.
So but I said, all right, this has to get fixed like now.
Yeah.
And so she went out and hired a, you know, nutritionist, and I mean, I hired him because she didn't work. And I hired all these people to help her with all of her stuff. And with everything on the line, she still couldn't put on the weight. She couldn't do it. And so she went down to Arizona for a month because she hated the cold without me because I had to stay here and work.
Yeah.
And then she hated being alone. So she's like, I want to come home. So I fly out there and I drive her back in her car and she doesn't eat anything all the way home. And that was it. That road trip was the straw that broke the camel's back. I'm like, can't do it.
Yeah.
I'm out. And 2 days later, I called an attorney and filed for divorce.
Yeah.
And moved out.
You know, I don't want to dive too deep into her, you know, because A, that's not really fair to her. And then B, this is supposed to be about you. It's not supposed to be about her. But I am.
Right. It's all about me.
Yeah. I do want to ask about her a little bit because I'm curious to understand more about how you approached connecting with her as she went through these struggles. So I guess first question, do you feel like she was really putting in a good faith effort, or was it more of like to placate you or maybe other family members?
I think she put in a good faith effort.
Okay.
I think she wanted to get better.
Yeah. And she was clearly like going through a lot of emotional issues and difficulty herself. How would you describe yourself? Like, how emotionally available or was your approach to it kind of like, hey, I'll pay for this doctor or this retreat or whatever, but like, go get yourself fixed? Or was it more like you were there like talking through the shit? I don't want to get too much into the ex-wife's business, but at the same time, it's important that I check to make sure that Jerry wasn't grossly negligent in his past relationship, as that would have massive repercussions for the advice I give about his current relationship. Here, I'm just doing what I sometimes call an asshole check, peering inside Jerry's intentions to make sure he's not being malicious or abusive in any way. Despite some of the insensitive remarks, he strikes me as a good guy.
I was present, you know. I mean, I went to shrinks with her.
Yeah.
You know, we did the marriage counseling stuff together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I went to that stuff. I was very much involved. I wasn't like, go fix yourself and come back when you're better.
Yeah.
I wasn't like that. It wasn't like that.
Okay, good. So you feel like you gave it your all too.
I did. I feel like that.
Yeah. And it sounds like that's part of the frustration and hurt on your end of like, Jesus, man, and like I gave it everything and, you know, I can't do this anymore.
Right. I felt like that. I was patient, put everything I had into trying to make it work. And yet I still feel guilty. And part of that is I blame her for part of that, and I probably shouldn't.
Yeah.
But when someone sends you an email every day that says, you gave up on us, you gave up on us, you gave up on us.
Yeah.
What happened to, for better or for worse, that impacted me.
Yeah, it's hard not to get resentful when somebody does something like that. You said you had another marriage.
Yeah.
That was before this one, I assume.
Yeah, that was before this one. So this is a girl I dated for 7 years, got married, and then got divorced like a year later.
Yeah. And tell me about that one.
Let's see. I was working in a shoe store, which is a great place to meet girls, by the way, if you want to sell women's shoes. And I met her there, and we dated for a long time, and then we got married, and then it was horrible. I was studying for the CPA exam. I was working 80-hour work weeks and not paying any attention to her, and she couldn't take it, and she left.
Yeah. So she broke up. She ended that one.
It was pretty mutual.
Yeah, yeah.
It was pretty mutual, but we didn't have any stuff or any kids or anything, so it was easy.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, in terms of dollars, emotionally, it was kind of...
Sucked. Yeah.
I mean, as those things do, generally.
They do kind of suck.
Divorce is not as fun as it sounds. Yeah. I mean.
Take note, kids. Divorce is not fun. Do you have kids now? I don't remember.
No, okay, no kids. Okay. Oh. She didn't want kids. I was on the fence.
Well, you didn't have sex, so there couldn't be kids.
Yeah. Turns out.
So this relationship you're in now, how long has that been going on?
6 months.
Okay. So long enough for it to be serious, but still feels new.
Feels new, and she's awesome.
Yeah. Why is that?
Because... so many reasons. We have a lot of things in common. She's so funny. She makes me laugh. She's not needy, really. Gives me my space.
So she's confident. She's got good boundaries.
Yeah.
And then what's the big anxiety for you?
The anxiety, I think we're in different places. She's also divorced, but she's been divorced for 12 years. And I've been divorced for 2 seconds.
So you're worried that... This is going too fast.
Yeah. Well, we see a lot of each other, and that's because of our bizarre living arrangement.
Okay.
So we live in the same apartment building, and she lives down the hall.
So she's a neighbor.
Yep. Which is really convenient.
It is convenient. Makes date night easy. But it's also... a lot of exposure? Like, does that make you anxious that you see her all the time, or?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit, you know, because I'm deathly afraid of where it could go.
What about sex? Are you guys having sex a lot?
If it was up to her, we'd have it like all the time, like every day. And she's 49.
Wow.
It's crazy, right? And that's what's so fucked up. It's like, I don't want to have it every day. And when I was in the old relationship, it was like, well, yeah, well, not every day, but you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and when you're feel deprived of something, you like vastly overestimate how bad you want it.
I don't want it as much as she does. But I think there's something more there, intimacy stuff there that I don't want to get too close. So.
Yeah. Do you get anxious?
Yeah, totally.
Okay. With the sex itself or just like the intimacy, like the physical intimacy? Like,
yeah, the idea of it.
Okay.
Well, and yeah, I mean, you know, you want to make them happy, right? And I'm not 22.
So. Yeah, I get you. So there's also a little bit of insecurity there, like.
Yeah. Yeah, that I'm not going to be the rock star that I think I am in my own mind.
And what does she say about that? Have you talked to her about this?
Yeah, she's cool. Yeah, you know, yeah. She gets it.
Yeah, I feel like by 49, a woman has seen every insecurity under the sun in a man. Like she's like whatever.
Yeah, that's how it was, you know. Yeah. I make a much bigger deal out of those things.
Yeah.
You know, if we lose our mojo for a while, you know.
Most men do. So first of all, one, you might just have a lower sex drive than her. Like that totally happens.
What a horrible problem I have. That reminds me of in The Subtle Art, you talked about that, right? About getting better problems.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man.
You've definitely got a much better problem.
God damn it.
But yeah, it might be, it sounds like it very well could be a generic problem, but the anxiety generated by the previous marriage gets you into an anxiety spiral.
It does, because, you know, in the previous one, you know, I was rejected so many times.
Yeah.
No, 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 no. You hear that for 20 years, it fucks you up.
Cue the Marvin Gaye, but this sounds like this could be sexual healing. It sounds like you might have actually like lucked into a situation that's very beneficial, like to be put in a situation where you're the one who is doing the rejecting. And
I know, how messed up is that?
It's not though, man.
I did. I turned her down. I can't believe
it's
that.
So the only thing that's messed up here is you telling yourself that. There's nothing wrong with saying, "Hey, I'm just not feeling it right now."
Yeah, as long as you're not feeling it right now because you're just not feeling it right now, not because you're afraid of getting close with someone.
Yeah.
Right? Is there a difference?
There is a difference, but it's still not messed up. I'm kind of harping on the semantics here, but I think it's important because if that's the language you use with yourself, hey, my insecurity is messed up. And a lot of that judgment, it comes from just like stupid cultural scripts that say like men need to be ready to fuck anything and everything at all times, which is completely not, you know, we are complicated and emotional creatures as well. You know, so I think it's important to not judge that insecurity. I mean, it sounds like you already have a good understanding of where it comes from, why it's there. And it's great that she's so understanding, because chances are in time it will dissipate and it'll stop being a problem. But yeah, the self-judgment there is like, it will make it worse, not better. So just chill with it. Just be like, you know what? This is my thing. This is my baggage. We'll give it a try again tomorrow night or whatever.
Okay.
So what other ways are you terrified of fucking this all up?
I am terrified. She likes to watch Cavs games with me, you know?
You're like, this is too good.
I know, right? Down the road, you know, we both live in this apartment building, right? She's going to be out of this place as soon as her lease is up, which is like next January, February. And then I'm terrified of that moment of that conversation. Like, what do we do now? She's going to be like, if I'm reading her mind properly, you should move in with me. And that fucking scares me. Because then I lose my freedom and my I don't know, then, oh no. Because, right? Because then you move in and the next thing you know, you're getting married to him. And the next thing, and then you're getting divorced and losing half your shit again. I can't lose half my shit again. I can't. It's too painful.
But I mean, you can just say no, or you can say you're not ready. I mean, first of all, that's like nine months away. And second of all, you're totally allowed to say, I'm not ready yet. She's probably not, I mean, assuming she's as cool as you say she is, it sounds like she would understand. I mean, have you had conversations with her about this, about like, hey, I've been divorced for 2 seconds and some of this is like freaking me the fuck out?
Yeah, yeah. I know she was a little freaked out even going out with me, because she's like, you're new. You just see me as a shiny object.
Yeah.
And she understands that. She's been really cool about all of that.
That's good. And have you told her like, hey, I really need to take this slow?
No, I haven't really said that.
Yeah.
I just kind of get anxious about it. And
she gives you space.
Don't say anything. I don't do confrontation very well. That's leftover baggage from marriage number one, because that was very confrontational. And so marriage number two is not confrontational at all, ever. And I'm not confrontational with her either.
Are there ever situations where you like want to confront her, or like kind of tell her to back off?
Yeah, but I'm trying not to give a fuck about anything. And so I give a fuck about nothing.
Jerry, that's not the point of the book, man. How
Did I miss it?
Did you read past the first 10 pages? That's not the point of the book.
Oh, shoot.
There's a whole chapter saying you have to say no.
Oh, I got to reread it.
Yeah.
I took notes, but I need to. I missed
There's
that.
A whole chapter saying healthy relationships require both people need to be able to say no and hear no.
Oh, all right. I'll reread. That'll be good homework. Yeah. I'll reread that.
There's your homework.
Because that's part of it. I need to recognize bad relationships and good ones. And
yes. And the more uncomfortable either of you is with saying no or hearing no from the other, the worse the communication is going to be, the worse the boundaries are going to be, the more you're just going to put up with bullshit and pretend like nothing's happening and go hide at work for 80 hours a week. So it's an important thing. I mean, first of all, it sounds like she's very aware of your situation. And
yeah, I've been pretty open with it, you know.
It sounds like she's very aware and cool about...
Too good to be true.
So, I mean, do you feel like you don't deserve this?
In a way, it's like, wait a minute, you know, I thought girls were psycho. You know? And she's like so not crazy.
I mean, believe it or not, there are emotionally stable, intelligent women out there.
No way. And this one like doesn't drive me crazy.
Yeah.
And she's hot. And wait a minute.
Yeah.
That can't. That's like a parallel universe. That's not Earth.
The amount of casual sexism I hear from both men and women who struggle with their romantic relationships is jaw-dropping at times. Somehow, it's culturally acceptable within this narrow domain to make sweeping judgments about entire populations for no other reason than you had your heart ripped out and impaled on a stick. I so often hear women lament that all men are pigs or assholes or they only care about sex. Similarly, I often hear men, like Jerry, complain that all women are too emotional or crazy or unstable. People develop these perceptions because they don't realize something incredibly obvious but hard to see. Every person you date has only one thing in common. You. If all the women you meet in your life are crazy or unstable, then guess what? You maybe aren't the pillar of decency you thought you were. Similarly, if all the men in your life seem detached, cold, or selfish, well, then it's time to start asking yourself some hard questions.
Well, it sounds like you come from a past where you weren't the most emotionally healthy or stable when you were younger, and the women you dated weren't emotionally healthy or stable, which that's how it works is, you know.
That's what I wanted. That's what I went after. I always went after broken ones.
Yeah. Did you do that consciously or unconsciously?
I don't know. My dad says I do. That's what I do.
Okay. So it's
you. He was against all of the marriages.
Yeah. But I mean, that's what works, right? If you feel broken yourself, then it's, you feel comfortable with another person who feels broken themselves, and because you get to feel broken together. But it sounds like you've grown and did a lot of work and fixing on yourself over the last 10, 20 years. And now you're actually in a place where you're having a relatively stable and healthy relationship. And that's just like, holy shit, it's you know, it's Aladdin. It's a whole new world.
It is a whole new world. And there's a lot of guilt around that.
Yeah.
It's like that I can be happy and I think about my ex-wife and it's like, well, I got to move on and I found a unicorn and you're miserable and hate me.
But I mean, obviously it always feels bad to, for your ex to be left in a very bad place. But it also sounds like maybe that guilt was part of the issue in the marriage itself with the, you know, this idea of like, you're responsible for fixing her or making her happy or getting her to a good place. And
well, she said I ruined her life when I left.
Well, yeah, but
which sounds messed up, right?
Yeah, but I mean, she's hurt, right?
Yeah,
I mean, you didn't, nobody's capable of ruining an entire life. Like, it's at some point she's gonna have an opportunity to make her own decisions and meet new people and move on.
Yeah.
So to me, that's just a translation for I'm really, really fucking hurt, which is obvious, you know, like.
Yeah.
But I mean, did you feel guilt within the marriage towards her? Guilt that she was struggling so much and.
I felt badly that I couldn't fix it. I fix things.
Yeah. So.
I'm a fixer.
Yeah.
But I couldn't fix her.
Yeah. And that might not have been. Like, it's one of those things that sounds very healthy and good on the surface. You know, if you have a spouse who's has some problems, you know, you the idea of fixing them sounds good, but it backfires in a lot of ways. So do you have any events or like big plans with the girlfriend coming up over the next few weeks?
Yeah, that's so funny that you ask. So for Mother's Day, she wants me to go meet her mother, sister, and brother. And so I have to gear up for that.
How are you feeling about it?
A little anxious.
Yeah. Have you told her that?
No. Why would I do that?
Because that's what healthy people do, Jerry.
I need a little note card. I need to write stuff on my hand.
If you want the stable and hot girlfriend, then you have to talk about these things. I mean, and it doesn't even have to be a big deal. Just be like, hey, like I'm a little nervous meeting your family.
It's not that I don't know what you worry about as far as it's just like one step closer to that person, you know?
It is. It is.
I have that. I'm looking forward to that.
Well, see how it goes, because I think this might be a good litmus test to gauge the pace of the relationship, because if it ends up being like a very, very uncomfortable experience for you.
Uh-huh.
That might be kind of a sign of like, hey, I'm not ready for this yet. I need to kind of put the brakes on a little bit and have that conversation with her. Or it might be one of those things where like you're nervous about it, but then you go and everything's going to be like everything's fine and great and you have fun and you're like, ah, that wasn't so bad.
So we got that. That's Mother's Day weekend. Then the next week we're going on vacation for a week together, like 24/7, like.
Oh, wow.
Sleepovers every night, right? So
it's a lot of sex, man.
Potentially, I know. So I could get laid every night for a week.
Oh, my God. That sounds awful.
No, I'm going to have to put up with that shit.
In this chapter, we've spoken to two completely different people with different backgrounds and different problems. Yet, psychologically speaking, their issues are remarkably similar. Two things strike me about Mimi after this first session. In over an hour of discussion about her relationships and dates, at no point does she discuss emotional attachment, intimacy, or even basic flirting. I'm thinking this is her blind spot. She thinks she's being open and upfront, but her perception of herself is skewed. She's being open in terms of information she's willing to share, but not the emotions that she's feeling. The second thing that stands out is a persistent and ongoing lack of boundaries. A guy is hanging around her for years without her ever getting clarity on what his feelings are. Like, what the actual fuck? Allowing an ex-boyfriend to deal drugs out of her dorm room? This all strikes me as problematic. And while I think she senses these are issues, my first impression of her is that she vastly underestimates their significance. Mimi is not alone in these boundary issues, of course. Jerry continues to engage with his ex-wife, who attacks him over text and email. And his chief preoccupation, that his new girlfriend will move in and, quote, take half my shit, is the very definition of a boundary violation. Pain can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. The more pain we experience, the more we distrust others and protect ourselves. But the more we protect ourselves, the harder it is to experience intimacy with somebody new, leaving us to only be attracted to those who are most likely to hurt us. When people hurt us,
when people impede on our lives and demand control of our emotions and attention, we lose our sense of self. We lose the ability to stand up for ourselves because it becomes unclear where we end and our partner begins. We become fearful of demanding respect for ourselves because it could potentially cause us even more pain. We surrender our own will and desires. We dedicate our energy to placating and pleasing others when they have no right. And after enough time, this begins to feel normal. So, the question is, how do you get over this? How do you move past your prior pain and create something healthy and fun and sexy and sustainable in the present? We tend to imagine the solution to our relationship problems as being this big dramatic moment where the clouds part and the angels sing and rainbows shoot out of our partner's ass and all is right with the world. But real change is far more subtle and powerful, and it begins with boundaries.